we're going to go through some very, very rocky times. Rising interest rates, and at the same time, deepening recession. What's going to happen to all those lovely fiat currency assets, or assets that depend on fiat currencies? It could be a major wipeout. Let me put it this way. I would not be surprised to see by the middle of this year, the dollar losing its purchasing power to the tune of, you know, possibly 25 to 50%.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. The U.S. dollar crushed nearly every other currency in 2022, though it's off nearly 10% from last year's highs now. While much debate currently centers around whether the dollar will weaken further or will resume its run higher in 2023, today's guest is more concerned about how much longer it has left as the preeminent currency in the world. When Alistair MacLeod, head of research for Gold Money, was on this program last, he made a dire prediction that the world's major fiat currencies were in the process of failing far faster than many were imagining. He returns to the program today to update us on the latest details and timing of his outlook. Alistair, thanks so much for joining us, especially late your time in the UK.
That's very much my pleasure, Adam. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Alistair. It's great to have you back. And as we were talking about before the camera started here, your last appearance on this channel is one of our most watched videos ever. So not trying to put too much pressure on you, but you've set a high bar. Let's see how we do with this one. All right. Well, a number of questions here for you, but let's just start with the high level one. I like to kick off when you come on this program, Alistair. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, it's splitting into two. First of all, if we look at America and what I call the Western Alliance, because that is now sort of lining up against the Asian hegemons, I think that we're heading for a rather nasty deep recession. Now, the reason I say that is that banks have moved away from risk. Now, they can't contract their balance sheets as much as they would like. They are over-leveraged, and particularly if you look at the American banks and take out the stuff which doesn't, which appears, if you like, as shareholders' funds, but doesn't qualify for tier one capital calculations, then the American banks actually have no balance sheet space at all. And that has been compromised by the huge quantities of quantitative easing since March 2020, so much so that roughly 2.2 trillion of that quantitative easing has now gone back into the Fed in the form of reverse repos. Now, this hides an underlying economic situation where the private sector is being crowded out from bank credit. Now, this is very, very important. What it means is that, in effect, the recession, which everybody is talking about, is not only here, but it is here in greater to a greater degree than the official statistics would reflect. And I think that's going to continue to be a problem. As well as that, I see interest rates remaining high because price inflation will remain high. Those analysts who think that a recession means that there will be softer prices, lower price inflation, in other words, make the mistake of not realizing that the consumption is basically funded at the end of the day by production. And the production will decline, if you like, hand in glove with consumption. So the price effect, I'm afraid, is going to be more driven by loss of purchasing power of the dollar. And the loss of purchasing power of the dollar is really a combination of the expanded quantity of credit in the US economy, both by the central bank and also by the commercial banking network, and the confidence or lack of confidence that people might have in the purchasing power, the future purchasing power of the dollar. So that's one half of it. As for the rest of the world, I think that China is very interesting. What I detect there is that China is going to accelerate her investment around Asia, which gives business to Chinese corporations and employs lots and lots of Chinese of the workforce. At the same time, this is driven by an accumulation of capital through a savings rate of around about 45%. There is only one other country that has a higher savings rate than China, and that's Singapore. So that doesn't really, if you like, sort of matter as far as the bigger world is concerned. But China is really quite remarkable in its savings rate. Now, not many people, I think, are aware of this. While we're struggling with consumer price inflation running at anything between 7 and 10%, depending where you are, in China, believe it or not, it's less than 2%. Why? Because of that savings rate. And that savings rate gives China the capital for the projects that she intends to implement all the way around Asia. So I see this having an adverse effect on us as well, because China's demand for energy, I think, is going to rise, probably a lot more than most analysts expect. And also her demand for key materials such as copper, equally, I think, will drive up prices measured in Western fiat currencies. So I see the world splitting into two halves. One half, which is our half, is going to be doing really rather badly, whereas China, Russia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union and BRICS, all these, which now also includes the Gulf Cooperation Council, their members, Saudi Arabia and so on, all those countries, I think, are going to be turning their backs on the failures of the West and embracing the prospects of Asia.
All right. Great summary. There's a lot you packed into that answer, Alistair. But parts of it do echo what a number of guests on this channel have said of late about this sort of bifurcation of world trade. We past couple decades, we have been used to increasing globalization and a more unipolar world. And of course, the dollar served as the world reserve currency. There now seems to be, especially accelerated by the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the West's response to that, this schism that you're talking about, where it really is Team America, or as you're calling the Western Alliance, versus the Asian hegemons, which of course you include Russia and some of the other BRIC countries in there. You just gave us a whole bunch of good reasons why you think the Western Alliance's prospects are going to be waning and the Asian hegemons' prospects are going to be rising going forward. This echoes a lot of what Zoltan Pozsar of Credit Suisse wrote in his very well circulated piece back in December. I want to get your thoughts on that too. But maybe quickly, let's stick with your comments about the future purchasing power of the dollar and let's say the other major world currencies right now. Because last time you were on this channel, you made a really bold prediction. You said that you expected the destruction of the world's current major fiat currencies within the next year to 18 months. And I'm just curious, what two things. One, can you refresh your views for, can you refresh for our viewers your reasons why you made that comment? And then maybe you can give us sort of an update on the timeline as you're seeing it right now, because it was, several months ago when you made that comment. I'm sure things have changed on the ground since then.
Indeed. I suppose two ways of looking at this. I mean, the one is from the domestic point of view. If you think that the pressure for monetary inflation has subsided, I'm afraid you've got to have another think coming, because inevitably the budget deficit, while it has narrowed recently, is going to increase again. That is the consequence of a recession. And as I said earlier, I think this recession is actually going to be a lot deeper than most people expect. I think it is already deeper than most than the statistics effectively reflect.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but not just recession, in this case, higher interest rates are ballooning the debt service payments as well, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's a combination of things. You end up with lower tax revenues and higher welfare costs. And as you say, the interest rate outlook, I think, pushes up really quite rapidly the debt servicing interests. In other words, America, and America is not unique in this, we all suffer this too. Britain, European Union, and also Japan are now ensnared in debt traps of their own historic making. And those debt traps, I think, are going to be sprung in the not too distant future. It will become apparent, I think, to investors that bond yields are going to have to rise and rise and rise because the demand for sorry, the government's demand, if you like, for funding is going to effectively flood the market with the requirement for purchasing these bonds. There is a separate issue here as well, and that is the international, the non-American ownership, the foreign ownership of US dollars and US financial investments. According to the US Treasury tick figures, they total now around about 30 trillion. They've already dropped from about 34 trillion, mainly due to portfolio effect, it must be admitted. But there has been some liquidation in there, and you can see that if you look carefully at the figures. Another point which is worth making is that with a trade deficit in the current fiscal year looking like almost $1 trillion, you would think that with the other side of the trade deficit would be capital imports, as it were, to make the trade balance. That is not happening. So the selling pressure on the dollar may not be readily visible, but it certainly is there. Now, I want to turn to the situation over Ukraine. Clearly, Putin has been misled by his generals. He does not have an army which is really fit for purpose. I would have to say that if you look at the war against the Russian war against Japan way back in, I think it was 1902, 1903, it played out in exactly the same way as the Ukraine situation has. So not a lot has changed in that sense. But what it does is it makes it more urgent for President Putin to prosecute a financial war. He's now got to rely on that to a far greater extent than he might otherwise if he'd been more successful with his Ukraine campaign. And it's beginning to be particularly important because the Western alliance are now increasing their supplies to the Ukraine. They're sending higher technology defense mechanisms there as well. So the pain is racking up, if you like, on the Ukraine front. Now, if we go back to the middle of last year, there was a St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which was attended by 14,000 people. And there were 81 official delegations and many, many diplomats and leaders who were there in an unofficial capacity as well. Now, what Putin said, and it's worth me just running through this because I've got it on my other screen here. Caught in the inflationary storm, many nations are asking, why bother exchanging goods for dollars and euros when they're losing value right before our eyes? Indeed, the economy of imaginary wealth is being inevitably replaced by the economy of real valuables and hard assets. This is as to Zoltan Pozsar's point. According to the IMF, today's, and remember, this is the middle of last year. According to the IMF, today's global foreign currency reserves contain $7.1 trillion and 2.5 trillion euros. And this money is depreciating at an annual rate of about 8%. Moreover, it can be confiscated or stolen at the whim of the US if it disapproves of something in a country's policy. I think this has become a very real threat for many countries that keep their gold and foreign exchange reserves in these currencies. According to objective expert analysis, in the coming years, a conversion process of global reserves will get underway. reserves will be converted from weakening currencies into tangible resources like food, energy, commodities, and other raw materials. Clearly, this process will further fuel global dollar inflation. Now, what is important about this is that he was quite clearly giving a signal to those 81 official delegations that they have got to sell dollars and sell euros and transfer whatever foreign currency reserves they feel they should have into perhaps the not so much the ruble, but certainly the Chinese yuan, and also commodities, particularly monetary commodities such as gold. Very, very clear signal. Now, what this means is that he can actually create the selling to drive the dollar down. And I would conclude that he has got more power over the future of the dollar than the Fed or indeed the US Treasury in the foreign exchange markets. Now, this is also falls very much in line with the experience in history of this sort of situation. When you get foreigners who are worried about the loss of purchasing power of a currency which they hold, they turn sellers first. Inevitably, what you find is that domestic users of that currency don't see this danger at all. And at the moment, when I talk to Americans, they don't see this danger at all. But what we can see is it from the international viewpoint. And I would ask anyone seeing this video to just think about that international aspect. That is where the weakness in the foreign exchanges will come. So as to the point in terms of timing, which was your basic question, we can see now that we are likely to get pressure for higher commodity prices coming through fairly shortly. Why? Because the winter is not over yet. You're going to get higher demand from China for energy, particularly oil. The oil price, I saw someone said that they expected the oil price to go to $140 on the back of the Chinese economic recovery, copper, and so on and so forth. All these things are going to rise in price measured in dollars. What that reflects is a loss of purchasing power of dollars as far as those commodities are concerned. So the people who are listening to Putin will be thinking very hard about making that switch. As to another point, interest rates are not over yet. They will continue to rise. And as they rise, bond yields will rise with them, which means that bond prices fall. You will find that Japanese institutions will be liquidating their US investments, not because they think that their domestic bond market is more attractive, but they don't want to take the physical losses in a foreign market. The same, I mean, they've already done this with French bonds. They've been selling French bonds for losses, basically because they can see that rising bond yields on French debt is destructive of portfolio values. And also not only bonds, but when it comes to equities, you will find foreigners will see an equity bear market developing, which they do not want to be involved with. So we can see that the dynamics for selling the dollar are there already. It's a process which is probably just beginning to start, because as I said earlier, most of the fall so far in the quantity of dollar investments plus bank balances has fallen from around about 34 trillion down to 30. Most of that I would put down to portfolio effect, but the selling I think is there and we are tipping on the edge. So where are we in terms of timing? Well, as I said earlier, I think President Putin has got the pressure on the Ukraine situation racking up against him. So he is not going to hang around. At the moment, certainly Europe is finding it's unseasonably warm. But if you look at longer range forecasts, we can expect a cold snap to start later on this month, maybe around about the 20th to 25th. When that happens, the ground will freeze very, very hard in the Ukraine. Whether Putin decides to advance his tanks under those circumstances, which he could well do, or whether he decides to continue with his current policy of making it unlivable in the Ukraine by removing all power generation, all electricity distribution, so that people are cold and hungry. Well, we have to wait and see. But I think that time is not far off. And as that cold snap spreads, we will also see gas consumption going up in Europe, which basically means that the European countries will be looking to top up their supplies, and they will be in the market for more gas. One of the things that's driven down the price of natural gas is their reserves are pretty much full. That is a situation which will change as the winter progresses.
All right. Very detailed answer. You're really proving that this is sort of such a multifactorial issue that's going on. I'm gonna maybe just pick up the question in a perhaps a different way here, which is you just talked about how Putin is likely going to escalate the financial war component, particularly because the ground war is not going exactly the way that he wants. In terms of your timing of a material amount of the world shifting away from the dollar into other currencies, as Putin begins to accelerate things, like when do you, I know you said we're just at the beginning of that process, but when do you think it's going to matter? I mean, are we still sort of in this 12-month from here timeline, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. Yeah. So what do you think?
I think it's going to matter sooner than that, because you've got to look at it, I think, from the Fed's point of view and also from the US Treasury's point of view. They already have an inflation problem. Inflation is currently running at something like 7% in America. It'll probably drop a bit further. But with interest rates where they are, which are what, 4.25% to 4.5% on the funds rate,
And headed higher still, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to go higher. There's pressure for them to go higher. I am sure that the Fed would rather like to see the transients of prices coming through as soon as possible. But realistically, that is going to be a waiting process. And that is best case. That really is best case. So if we have a situation where the dollar starts to weaken, measured against commodities in particular, and gold as a signal, if you like, of that, then I think it's probably going to drive the authorities in America to act sooner rather than later. What happens with the other currencies? I can see that there are foreign exchange positions which need to be reversed, because until very recently, the right thing to have done would have been to sell yen, sell euros, buy dollars, and pick up the interest rate differential. Mm-hmm. This is reflected, if you like, in currency crosses, currency forwards, something like 90% of which, according to the Bank of International Settlements, have dollars on one leg. So there's a lot of unwinding of that situation to occur. So in this initial phase, I would expect to see a rally in the other currencies, not because I think they're any better than the dollar. I mean, quite honestly, I think that the euro has got a very limited life. I don't think it'll survive this at all. But you can see why there's a certain amount of repatriation of funds, if you like. And this also ties in with what happens with bear markets. I mean, in bear markets, what do? You sell the foreign stuff in your portfolios. And if the foreigners own, on current figures, roughly $30 trillion, of which I think about 12, 13 or 14 trillion is invested in stocks, what do? that's on the market all of a sudden, and it could happen very, very quickly. So it would be too simplistic to point to just one thing, but to accept your phrase that there are many moving parts in this. Those parts, I think, are going to come together, and they will probably come together fairly quickly, because from Putin's point of view, he cannot afford to hang around. And I think I would like to make another point. His strategy for some time has been to let America make all the mistakes. I think that's changing. And I think it's also changing as far as China is concerned. And the thing that's fascinating, and this is a, if you like, a marker for us, Saudi Arabia has clearly taken the signal from the Western Alliance that, you know, in another 10 years or 20 years or whatever, we don't want to have fossil fuels. So we're not going to do any business with you and your fossil fuels. So go away, Saudi Arabia. Go away, Gulf Cooperation Council. Meanwhile, what does China do? China comes along, does a deal with Qatar for 27 years' supply of natural gas.
Right.
President Xi goes to Saudi Arabia, you know, and all the flags are out and all the rest of it. And, you know, he's sort of walking along there, going to the palace, the royal palace, you know, flanked by horsemen and all. I mean, you know, this. Did Biden get any of this? I don't think he did. You can see where this is going.
No, quite not. He only got a fist bump, I believe.
Hardly that, I think. But anyway, yeah, good point. He didn't even get what he gave Putin at the G20 there, which was the one before this last one, which was high five. I don't know if you noticed that. They had obviously come to an agreement without telling anybody else. So what we now have is Saudi Arabia wanting to join BRICS. They've said that. They are also applying to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as, you know, in an associated form. And very importantly, as far as we're concerned, they have marked the birth of the petro-yuan and the death of the petrodollar. Now, this isn't going to happen, let's say, overnight. I mean, but it's a gradual process. You can see where this is going.
Right.
If we no longer have the requirement to hold dollars to buy our energy, but we can do it with yuan, and remember, that's an economy which is going to be demanding this energy, and the currency will go up on that basis relative to the dollar, it's bound to, then what are you going to do? You're going to sell dollars, you're going to buy yuan.
Okay.
And so, another one little marker in this, which I think is a side issue, but indicative of where this is going. The Russian National Wealth Fund has just changed its articles so that it can hold 60% of its assets in yuan and 40% of its assets in gold. Now, that is very important. This is not a huge fund, but the point about it is that if you know your gold history, you will know that Sir Isaac Newton, when he was Master of the Royal Mint, worked out that the correct backing for the currency should be 40% specie. Now, in those days, it was silver, and then he set a gold-silver ratio, which gave everybody a headache, but eventually it went on to gold, 40%. What is the Russian National Wealth Fund doing? 40%. So I think apropos of Zoltan Pozsar's sort of rather vague story about, you know, moving, you know, Bretton Woods 3 and all the rest of it, this is putting a bit of flesh on it.
All right. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I know we're sort of working our way to gold in this discussion. We've been talking about the fiat currencies up until now. But now you're getting into, you know, the petro yuan, right, where, you know, all of a sudden yuan is being tied to oil. And we have seen, and you have talked a lot about the fact that I believe the progression that you see is shifting away from the purely fiat regime back to some form of commodity-backed currencies. There's been a lot of talk of late of potentially China eventually backing the yuan by gold, and talk about Russia backing the ruble by gold. So what do you see right now in terms of the progression here? Do you see a hard asset-backed currency emerging on the world stage anytime soon?
It's too early to say that. I mean, the one thing I have noticed is the jealous way in which central banks hoard their gold. And, you know, these guys aren't really interested in you or me. They're not interested in what we think about gold. What they are interested in is holding on to gold, because it's no counterparty risk, and legally it is money and the rest is credit. So they understand.
Are you sure it's just not a barbarous relic? just to make fun of Bernanke's
dismissiveness
of it, right? But you're basically saying, look at what they do, not what they say.
Obviously. But it's just to be pedantic. Actually, what Cain said was it was the gold standard, which was a barbarous relic, not gold itself. But I mean, other people since then have called it a pet rock. So, you know, I think, no, I mean, that's nonsense. The fact of the matter is that legally, money is gold or silver or copper, physical metal. And of course, you know, today we talk about gold in particular as opposed to the other two. And it's a very, very important point to realize that the distinction between gold and currencies and bank credit is that gold is money. It is legal money. There is no counterparty risk. The rest is credit, which is exactly what the original J.P. Morgan said in testimony to the Congress back in 1912. And he was right. I mean, he was right. I don't see them at this stage parting with gold or offering a gold exchange standard, you know, rather like the British one, which went from 1817 to 1914. But the thing that's interesting is that with the amount of global capital that is likely to go into the yuan in the coming years, the Chinese could well find that they don't want to see the yuan driven up to ridiculous levels. Now, they can control that by either one of two means, probably both. The obvious one is by expanding the amount of credit, which they will do. They will do to finance the developments and all the rest of it all around Asia. That is easy. But that might not be sufficient to keep the yuan, if you like, at a level which everybody is comfortable with. But so the way you do that maybe is to use gold to keep the yuan down. Now that's a thought which I don't think anybody is really talking about at the moment. But it occurs to me that if a gold standard is going to be introduced, it will probably be for that reason, rather than the one which we would expect, which would be to stabilize currencies to stop them falling in purchasing power. In any event, one of the problems, I mean, the big problem with using a gold standard is that you can't just go on a gold standard without amending your fiscal policy. The level of taxation in the West is so destructive of economic performance that you can't have an economy which is going to perform reasonably well, without substantially cutting the government involvement in the economy. It means reducing it right back. And if you look at, the real success post-war, of course, was Hong Kong. And there the taxes were fixed at, I think, 13 or 14%. No other taxes. There was just income tax. That was it. And government spending was controlled accordingly. I mean, I can't really imagine that happening in a Western, in any member of the Western alliance yet. We don't need to go down the rabbit hole of Italy or France or whatever.
Right. No, I just can't imagine any, current sitting political body in the West proactively deciding to shrink themselves as dramatically as would be needed to do that. Right. If it were to happen, it would only be forced upon them.
Well, exactly. No politician has the mandate to do that. The only time that he would get a mandate to do that would be in a real crisis where currency collapse, for example, and you've got to try and rebuild an economy out of nothing. Under those circumstances, you could probably cut government involvement in the economy and get away with it. But not until. It's crisis first, solution second, I'm afraid.
Okay. All right. Well, look, let's go into gold. And let me kind of re-ask my earlier question as we get into gold, which is, I know you just wrote a piece, Prospects for Gold in 2023. So why don't you share your outlook for gold for the coming year? But maybe as an entry into that, beyond just gold as an investment vehicle, from what we've just been talking about, it sounds like you think its role as a monetary vehicle will be rising from here. You know, unclear perhaps exactly how it gets manifested. You gave one way in which it could be by China, but anything else you might want to say about gold's monetary prospects as well, we'd love to hear.
Yeah, most gold bugs look at it from the point of view, you know, is gold going up measured in dollars or whatever currency you like? And they see it treated as an investment. And by that, I mean that you buy gold with a view to making a profit in you know, the currency of your choice. That is not the way to look at it. The first point to understand is that gold is legal money, and it is therefore something that you own when you want to get out of the risk of fiat currency. So that's the first point I'd like to make. And, you know, everybody I talk to, I've always encouraged them to try and look at it that way. Now, the other thing is that if you look at the purchasing power of gold for millennia, I mean, we can go back to Diocletian's edict, which I think was around about 230 AD or something, a long time ago, 1800 years ago. He set maximum prices in stone, and you can look at those prices. One of the things that's interesting is the gold-silver ratio was 12 on that edict. But the prices of things like, you know, clothing and food and beer and so on and so forth are pretty much the same today as they were then. There are variations, of course.
When priced in gold.
When priced in gold, exactly. And of course, fiat currencies have come and gone ever since. So really, going on that theme, what I did was I looked at the price of commodities in fiat currencies and also in gold. And actually, the person who first did this was James Turk. He published a book recently where he showed his favorite chart, which I've seen him present many times, of the price of oil in gold and the price in dollars. Now, the price in dollars going back to 1950 was around about $2.60, something like that, a barrel. Today it's what, $75 a barrel? Mm-hmm. The price in gold has actually fallen by roughly 20% over that time with minimal volatility. Now, to test this hypothesis, I also did it for baskets of commodities, baskets which are put together by the IMF's database. And when you look at metals, agricultural products which are non-seasonal, in other words, not bound to a harvest cycle, and various other raw materials. You can see that it's exactly the same story. The price of these things in gold, if you take an index of them, you know, the different indices, and you average it out, the most you see is, you know, they may double, they may halve, but that's it. Whereas in paper currencies, it's not unusual to see something go up, you know, several thousand percent. But it's because it's the paper currency going down. That's the important point. So when I look at the prospects for gold, really what I think people must do is to understand that it's not the prospects for gold, it's the prospects for the fiat currencies which it is measured in. That's what you've got to look at. That's what I look at. And that's why I emphasize as much as I can that the future for the currencies is most important. And that is why what Putin says is something that we should listen to, because he has the power to undermine the purchasing power of the dollar, which, you know, drive up the price of gold to, in measured in dollars, to whatever you like. It really doesn't matter. But the fact of the matter is that it's gold which is sort of trackling along on a constant path, where it's the dollar going down. And I think once you can grasp that, I think you can formulate an idea as to why or why not you should hold gold as opposed to dollars.
Okay. And you said at the beginning of this conversation that you think the prospects for the Western-based fiat currencies are waning going forward. And obviously, I think from what you just said, you're saying kind of the arbitrage is the wrong word to use, but the differential of purchasing power of Western fiat currencies waning purchasing power of gold, if not waxing, is at least holding steady. And so, you know, the way to preserve your purchasing power, and who knows, maybe even some relative gain, you know, is making the shift from paper to physical. Is that accurate? Yeah.
Absolutely. That is accurate. I mean, I would add to that, that if we have a situation, which I would not be surprised, of Western fiat currencies declining very sharply, then there will be a rush into gold, which will drive up the value of gold measured against other commodities. It's bound to.
But there it'll will add be some speculative problem. Fervor to it, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah.
Or not speculative, but maybe desperate.
Yes, I think that's probably a better description. Exactly. But I mean, it will. It's extremely unlikely that its purchasing power will go up, you know, maybe more than twice, something like that, measured in other currencies. I mean, if you go back to the hyperinflation in Germany in 1922 and 23, the purchasing power of gold was constant in dollars, but what it was the loss of purchasing power of the paper mark. So right. that, you know, you could, I mean, there were reports of foreign students at Berlin University who out of their, you know, the money in dollars sent to them by mum and dad, they could buy streets of houses, you know. And there was you could also have bought, you know, a really good 6-bedroom house in a posh part of Berlin for $100. And $100 at that time was just a little less than five ounces of gold. So, but what it is it's the loss of the purchasing power of the currency. That is the thing that impoverishes everybody. And you want to be in a position where you're not caught out. If you like, in that, in that sort of decline.
All right. So let's talk about the risk of that kind of decline in terms of sort of your threat level, right? Where we are today, you know, sounds like you're saying, look, people should be beginning, you know, should at least be making the transition of investing some of their paper going forward more and more into physical. but is this sort of, you know, do it gradually as you can, dollar cost averaging, or is this sort of a storm warning like, hey, the you know, potential for a big drop in loss of purchasing power in these Western fiat currencies, the risk is much higher these days than it used to be, and therefore act more swiftly?
Well, the former approach is an investment approach, which I would strongly discourage. That's not the way to look at it. You should be looking at hoarding gold as a safety mechanism. To protect your life, really, because, you know, measured in declining currencies, you know, any asset that you have is going to lose value relative to gold. So you can see that really you should be holding gold, hoarding gold. It's not an investment. It is something that you will eventually spend. As to, you know, how close we are to a cliff edge on this, I think we are actually quite close to a cliff edge. And this is why, you know, I went to some trouble to repeat what President Putin said in the middle of last year. I think there's, you know, there is every indication that we're going to war against Russia. We're putting greater pressure on Putin. And under those circumstances, I don't think it can be very long before he takes whatever action he thinks will undermine the purchasing power of the dollar. It always starts on the foreign exchanges first. It will lose substantial purchasing power through the foreign exchanges to begin with. You will find that resident Americans, or in my case, resident Brits, will not understand what's happening to their currency. Mm-hmm. So they will not understand that it's actually just worthless paper until it is too late. And then you get what Ludwig von Mises called the crack-up boom, when finally everybody just gets rid of every bit of currency they've got in their hands they can grab hold of to buy the goods. Whether they need them or not, they just want to get rid of the paper. So that is really, you know, the end of the currency. And I wouldn't say at this stage that we are going to go to that extent, but to stop it will require Western governments to back off from this Keynesian idea that the gold standard as a barbarous relic, that we can stimulate our way out of trouble and all the rest of it. That has got to go. You have got to have a completely new way of thinking in the amongst the monetary authorities. You have got to have an acceptance that the only way to stabilize the currency is to turn it into a substitute for gold. And that means bringing in a credible gold exchange standard. So how long do we wait until we get there? I mean, does the dollar fall to the point where, 10,000 buys an ounce of gold or 100,000 buys an ounce of gold? I really don't know. We'll have to see at the time with what sort of alacrity the monetary authorities actually move. I suspect that with preconceived ideas, which have moved away from the classical economics into macroeconomics, particularly of the Keynesian and monetarist variety, there will be a huge reluctance to accept anything like a return to gold as money and the rest is credit. And understanding that you can only protect the value of credit by anchoring it to gold.
Okay. I just want to distill several things you said, Alistair, just to make sure I'm capturing it correctly for the viewers here. You are saying, given kind of the current threat level, and this is not personal financial advice, but you're basically saying it's more of a run, don't walk moment in terms of building up your exposure to gold here. And the danger of not doing that, you're saying, is not taking action until it's too late, where you already explained that you think, the vast majority of folks probably just won't understand what's going on until when they do, it's way too late to take corrective action. You also said something really interesting, and I just want to make sure that we flesh out for people, is you said, I think you used the term hoard gold, but as I understand you, gold is not the end. In your mind, right? Gold is the means by which you protect your purchasing power as we sort of shift from one regime to the other. And then what you want to do is deploy it into other assets when the new regime is up and running. And to use a really extreme example of that, we'll mention again your example there of Weimar Germany, where somebody was able to take five gold coins and buy one of the nicest houses in the block.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. And it's, another point I would make is that, the idea that you can sort of maybe, buy it on declining prices or whatever. Now, that's an investment approach. It's important to understand Gresham's law in this, and that is that the bad money drives out the good. The good money is gold. The rest of it is credit. The credit starts collapsing, you got to have gold. I mean, it's really, that is as simple as that.
And to that point, I want to let you talk about this. We have already sort of seen that in relatively recent periods of time over the past two decades, since I've known you, Alistair, where the precious metals markets have really tightened supply-wise, right? We certainly saw that happen in silver just as recently as 2020, right? Where premiums went through the roof. They're actually still pretty high even 2 years later, but you couldn't get any, right? I mean, sure, you could get a dealer who would be willing to sell you silver, but in terms of delivery, you might be told you have to wait, weeks to maybe months, or, hey, I'm not entirely sure, right? So part of the story about the point of Gresham's law is bad money can drive out the good money to such an extent that even if you want it, you can't get your hands on the gold money.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think in that sense, gold is easier to obtain than silver. I mean, if you want huge, great quantities, then join the queue is the answer. But for most of us, who don't have millions or billions of paper currency, whichever one it is. I think that, the gold should be reasonably available. I mean, that's what we do at Gold Money. We store gold, silver, and also platinum group metals, though they're meant to be precious metals, but they're not monetary metals. We store that for our customers around the world, and we don't have a problem. I think we've got a certain amount of inventory, though, that's not not my activity at all in gold money, so I don't really know. But we haven't had any problem really acquiring gold and silver for for our customers. So, I mean, it is perfectly possible for individuals to accumulate gold and silver at current prices or close to current prices. Another aspect which is worth mentioning is, and I'm not quite sure how it works in America, but in this country, sovereigns are legal tender. Now, this is important because if you want to, say, buy an asset, let's assume that sterling has collapsed and you want to buy an asset, then you can buy an asset with legal tender where legal tender is required to buy that asset. I mean, I'm thinking about property and things like that, for example. So, there are, sort of little things to take into account here. I think you need to do your research for your own personal circumstances to see what actually best suits how you see your life going through what inevitably is going to be a very, very challenging time over the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay. One of the things I tell people, Alistair, is the difference between having a couple ounces of gold and no ounces of gold. And I know your recommendation is not just to stop at a couple ounces, but the difference of having a couple ounces of gold is you already have more gold than like 99% of the population,
yes.
Right? Yeah, so if we were to wake up, and I know you're not saying it's gonna be like this, but if we were to wake up one day and the regime change happened overnight monetarily, your relative, how better off you are relative to everybody else can be dramatically different, even just having a couple of these ounces, because you've got something that, again, 99% of the world is desperate for and doesn't have.
Yes. I mean, I think another way to put what you're saying is, a few ounces of gold would be something like an insurance policy, if you like.
Right.
It makes sense, I think, in that context. And the great thing is that everything else can go to hell in a handcart, but there'll always be demand for gold in exchange for goods and services. So, ultimately, you might be just spending gold sovereigns or silver dollars or whatever it might be to buy those goods and services. But in the interim, until the currency really collapses, if you can fix a price, then you can actually sell gold to raise that currency like that. So it works. It works, either way. It's, and I can't emphasize strongly enough that legally, the only money is metallic gold, metallic silver, or metallic copper. Principally, metallic gold. That is the only form of money, legal money, in existence. And it's been like that from Roman times. I mean, going back to the 12 pandects of about 1500 BC, then formalized in Justinian's pandects and retranslated into the Eastern Roman Empire in Byzantium, and then translated again back into European law in the form of the Swiss translation of them. For every country in Europe, and also every country within the our British Empire, which included you, by the way, at one stage. Yeah. It is legal money. It still is.
An artifact of that is that, when the Constitution was written, it says in there that the only form of legal tender is supposed to be gold and silver specie. And of course, we've somehow turned a blind eye to that now that we've entered the fiat regime. Yeah. But it is still codified there in our Constitution.
Yeah. So when credit goes to hell in the handcart, I mean, whether it's because the banks go bust or whatever, I mean, there's so many things that can happen. I'm not saying that the banks necessarily will go bust, but you can see that we're going to go through some very, very rocky times, rising interest rates, and at the same time, deepening recession. What's going to happen to all those lovely fiat currency assets or assets that depend on fiat currencies? It could be a major wipeout for that classification of asset. So, to my mind, there is only one sensible thing to do, and that is hedge out of total fiat dependency. And you can only do that by having real money.
Okay. As we wrap up here, Alistair, I'm going to ask you some probably unfair questions to be tossing you this late in the conversation. And we'll just take quick answers at this time. But I know you don't like people to think of gold in this way, but you recently wrote your prospects for gold in 2023. Do you have any sort of price target in mind, or at least a sense of how you think it's going to perform, you know, versus other currencies, given all the trends of this year?
No. You wanted a brief answer, because that's not the way I look at it. I mean, the way I look at it, and this is actually after a lot of thought. It's not just me, but right.
I'm asking you this not to undo all the good work of this discussion, but it's still a way that many people think, and so of I want course. To try to pull them into the discussion by speaking their language.
Well, all right, let me put it this way. I would not be surprised to see by the middle of this year, the dollar losing its purchasing power to the tune of, you know, possibly 25 to 50%. I would not be surprised. I think it would require a certain level of crisis to get there. It might require President Putin to panic and say, right, we've got to put the sell orders in for gold. It might just be everybody waking up to the points which we've been discussing in this video. Hold on a minute. You know, the Western Alliance is 1.2 billion people who are basically resting on their laurels, going woke, not working, compared with the 3.8 billion people in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which basically is most of Asia, who are rapidly industrializing. Have the prospects for a strong Chinese economy driving the whole of that continent while we languish. And, you know, we sort of turn around and say, well, you know, we don't want fossil fuels. And they're, meanwhile, getting the benefits of nice, cheap energy, whereas we're turning our back. I don't know how it's going to work out like that, but I can see we are destroying ourselves, if you like. I never, ever put in targets for the price of gold or the price of anything, because I know from my own personal experience that it's never right.
It's just got it. Yeah.
Estimates. So I'm sorry, I'm going to duck that one. But what I will say...
Saying that the dollar might lose 50% of its purchasing power this year, people can do their own math.
It could easily do that. And I may be underestimating the loss. I may be overestimating. Who knows? We can't know. I mean, I've read enough documents about, you know, the prospects for the future to know that it's all, pardon my expression, bullshit. It's just guesswork. It really is.
Totally get exactly. But I think it's fair to say, given your current outlook, you see good potential for dollar down hard and gold up as measured in other currencies, which you encourage people not to think about it in any ways.
Yeah.
All right. And then last... it's super unfair for me to ask you this at the end, because I'm sure you could opine about it for a lot longer. I just know if I don't ask it, that we're going to get a lot of comments and the questions from the people that follow this closely, which is not a huge percentage of this audience, by the way. But is there a role for, you know, Bitcoin, crypto to play here? Or do you have a particular position against crypto as a potential solution here? Because of course, that's what you hear from a lot of people, which is like, oh, well, if you think gold's going to be good about, you know, protecting your purchasing power, crypto is the real answer.
Absolutely. I mean, the answer is no. I don't see it having any role whatsoever. It is born out of speculation in paper money. And everybody who owns Bitcoin is thinking that, you know, I bought it at $15,000 or whatever it might be, and I think it's going to go to 500,000, 2 million, you know, they're all bulls. And the point about being bullish about Bitcoin is you buy it at one price in the hope that you're going to make a wonderful profit in dollars. You know, that's actually what it's about. Now, the whole of the crypto industry is going through massive problems. I don't need to dwell on those. Mm-hmm. So far, it hasn't affected the price of Bitcoin. But it's hard to see how the exchanges and the whole sort of crypto structure is likely to survive. I would also make the point that there is a legal distinction in criminal law between money and credit on the one hand, and other forms of assets, which also include cryptocurrencies. And the distinction is this. If, let us say, you have a painting on your wall and someone steals it, and later on you find it on someone else's wall, someone who bought that painting in good faith from another party, it's still your property. You may have to go through a few hoops to prove it, but it's still your property. You can claim that property back, and no compensation to the new owner, in inverted commas, is required. This is the basis on which Jewish families in particular have been recovering assets stolen from them by the Nazis. So that is one category. Now, when you look at money and credit, if someone, let's say, breaks into your house and steals your wallet with, you know, lots of lovely $100 notes in it, and or $1 notes, depending who you are, and then goes and spends them in a shop, the shopkeeper takes them in good faith, you can't claim that back. It's a very important legal distinction. And this again goes back to Roman law, the difference between money, credit, and other forms of property. So now we turn to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not legal money. That's the important point. Furthermore, it has a blockchain behind it, which means that the authorities can work out if the Bitcoin that you own or was last seen going into your wallet was the proceeds of crime from someone earlier down the blockchain. Mm-hmm. So you have absolutely no security of possession of your Bitcoin. Now, I've had, you know, enthusiasts say, well, you know, they can't access my wallet and all the rest of it. But really what they're doing is they're saying, the law can't be applied to it. I'm sorry, but that's not a way forward.
Huh, that's super interesting. I'm not a crypto expert, but, you know, yeah. Just from what you've just said there, Alistair, let's project ourselves 10 years into the future. And you've got some Bitcoin in your wallet, your cold storage wallet at that point in time, or wherever it is. Presumably you could get contacted by the authorities saying, hey, we just found out that 8 years ago, at some point along the history of those Bitcoin, yeah, it was used in a fraudulent activity, and therefore the claimant prior to that is really the true guy who's got the claim on this Bitcoin. So exactly. We're going to take it back.
Exactly. And they can access all the records of the miners. And not only that, but every exchange where you might have bought this, if you haven't got it, you know, from a miner, has to do KYC, know your customer, money laundering regulations and all the rest of it. So you will be identified as the last person to which that little, you know, whether it's a whole Bitcoin or a part Bitcoin, actually went. So the idea that the authorities, can't track you down if they really have a go at Bitcoin, is not true. They're already doing it, from what I understand. So this is a very important weakness. I mean, the idea of the blockchain as a self-auditing process, I mean, brilliant concept. But in terms of property, it's actually property rights, it actually turns out to be very, very bad news. I also think that it's quite possible that as the whole cryptocurrency thing collapses, which it is doing at the moment. I'm not saying that the collapse will actually be Bitcoin, but it's all the others. I think you'll find that the authorities will feel keener to clamp down on this sort of speculative activity, and they will make it extremely difficult for you to buy and sell Bitcoin.
Okay. And there's all sorts of questions about CBDCs and whatnot, Alistair, but we're going to have to leave that to the next time we have you back on this channel here. Thanks so for giving us so much of your time here again, Alistair. Very critical topic. I mean, there's very few things more foundational to the global economy and the financial system than actually the money that we use. All right. So for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion with you, perhaps maybe the first time they've been exposed to you, where can they go to learn more about you and follow your work?
I write a weekly article, which is published on goldmoney.com. And that's on Thursday, and it's released about sort of midday-ish, I suppose, Eastern Standard Time. And on Friday, the following day, I do a market report, which is basically a sort of market-related summary of, you know, sort of what's happened in the week and how I see things developing. So that is a bit more angled, if you like, at the investment community, even though I've just denied that they shouldn't be involved with this. But anyway.
All right. And those are both on goldmoney.com, correct?
Goldmoney.com. Yeah. Both of them are on. I'm head of research there, and that is what I do.
Great. And you also have a Twitter account, right? You post to Twitter from time to time?
Yep, at McLeod Finance. So if you want to join the happy or not so happy band of Twitter followers, please do. Love to
Great.
Have you.
All right. Well, when we edit this, Alistair, we will put up the links to both goldmoney.com and your Twitter handle so folks know exactly where to go. All right. Well, look, folks, in wrapping up here, one quick free resource for you. For those of you that may have been motivated by Alistair's discussions here, especially about the wisdom of owning precious metals, I get bombarded with those questions all the time in terms of how to buy them. I'm sure Alistair does as well. Certainly go check out goldmoney.com and their solutions there. But at Wealthion, I've written sort of a free primer that just sort of goes through all the major options available to the novice, to intermediate, and even in some cases, advanced bullion or gold owners. And, you know, there's a number of different ways you can own it, and there's pros and cons to each. So that free primer just sort of explains it all and may be very helpful in helping you determine where you want to start. To go read that, just go to wealthion.com/how-to-buy. And also, too, Alistair made some, you know, I think made this point very well throughout the conversation here, but you know, if you go to a traditional financial advisor and look for their help, they oftentimes they try to steer you away from the precious metals. And in most cases, it's because they can't collect a fee off of them. And so they try to talk you out of them. In fact, you know, kind of a very common refrain, and Alistair is sort of smiling and laughing as I'm saying this, from a traditional financial advisor is, you want to own some gold? Well, only crazy people own gold, right? Well, Alistair just told you all the reasons why it's not. Highly recommend that as you build your financial plan and especially if you want to have your portfolio managed by a professional, which I advise that almost everybody watching this do, you want to find a financial advisor that is aware of all the issues that Alistair and I talked about here and that has a healthy respect for the role that precious metals can play in your portfolio. If you have a good one that already does that, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion of one who does, feel free to talk to one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, just fill out the short form at wealthion.com to set up a free consultation with them. Again, it's free. It doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They really just offer it as a public service to help make people better informed, help people make better informed decisions with their wealth, you know, in regards to all the trends and issues that Alistair and I have just been talking about for the past hour here. Last, if you've enjoyed having Alistair on this program, would like to see him come back on at some point soon, please do us a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Alistair, I can't thank you enough, buddy. I hope we can have you back on soon.
I'd love to be back, and thank you very much for having me, Adam.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Alistair. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.